gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States against $100,000. Mr. Kuhn.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, I'd like to start with the jurisdictional question in this case. And in granting the motion to suppress, the district court did not dispose of all claims against all parties. It was not until after the July 5, 2007 order and that accompanying final judgment that the district court actually disposed of all claims against all parties in this lawsuit, and it was not until that time that this case actually became appealable. The district court had not ruled at that point, up until the time, on the interest of the claimants, the interest of the United States, or even on the merits of the forfeiture. And this being a civil case and not a criminal case, there was no right to take an interlocutory appeal, and needed to wait until the case was properly included in the district court before bringing it up here to this court.
There's something I don't... Well, let's see if I can do it this way. Once the court granted Fallon's motion to suppress the seizure of the funds and denied the government's motion to reconsider and declared the case terminated, why didn't the government either turn over the funds or file a motion stating that the defendant had not made a proper showing of an interest in the property? I mean, I noted that even in the government's own briefing, you state that once evidence is suppressed in a forfeiture proceeding, the ball remains in the government's court. If the ball was in the government's court, why did the government do nothing but wait for the claimants to make the next move? Can you help me?
Well, the ruling on the motion to reconsider came a long time after the actual suppression hearing. In fact, it was almost 2.5 years later. We needed some time to revisit the case and determine what our next step was. It was not the most hasty decision we could have made, and in fact, at the time that the claimant went forward and filed their next motion, we were in the process of determining how best to proceed with the case.
Well, is the bottom line of what you're saying is that you waited 2.5 years to make a decision?
The district court waited two and a half
right.
years to make a decision. Once we got the ruling on the motion to reconsideration, I believe the claimant filed their next motion about 80 days later.
Uh-huh.
And it was during that time was when we were in discussions trying to determine what we should do next.
Did the government ever go to Judge Bucklow and say, we're waiting for this decision?
Well, we had, in response to the first filing by the claimants, that was basically what we said. And the judge agreed with us and said this motion for return of property filed by the claimants is premature. There are still other issues in the case that have to be decided before we can get to return of the property and who it should go to, because there were, in fact, two claimants in this case. Turning to the merits of the case, basically there was an unemployed waiter who purchased a one-way ticket on Amtrak with cash, who nervously sweated his way through some untruthful answers to the agent's questions, and he was carrying at least $50,000 in cash in a locked bag for which he did not have a key. This provided abundant reasonable suspicion for the agent to detain this bag for further investigation, which is what happened. Then the bag was removed from the train and taken to the Amtrak office, where it was placed for a drug detection dog test and potentially an alert for the smell of illegal drugs on this money. The district court found that prior to the detention of the bag and the dog sniff test, that the agent unlawfully peeked into the bag and saw that there was money in it. Based upon that, she initially suppressed the funds. In our response to the motion to suppress, we argued, first of all, that there was consent that the district court didn't go with, but we also argued in the alternative that if the court finds that there isn't consent, there was additional information, including the dog sniff, that was not based upon this unlawful search that would lead to probable cause for the seizure of the money in the institution of these forfeiture proceedings. The district court found that we didn't raise the inevitable discovery doctrine by arguing that in our response. But the actual substance of what we said was, in fact, the inevitable discovery doctrine, even though we didn't use those particular words. At this particular time, we were responding to a motion to suppress that was based upon two basic factors. One, that the encounter on the train between the agents and Mr. Fallon was not a consensual encounter, but was, in fact, a seizure from the beginning, and secondly, that the detention of the bag and the time that it took from the time the bag was detained until the time the drug dog got there exceeded the bounds of the Constitution. So that's what we responded to, and the court said, well, there's a non-consensual search here, and I also find you didn't raise an inevitable discovery. We submit that a district court was incorrect in that ruling and that we should be able to go forward with this case on the inevitable discovery of
What was the other evidence that you alluded to in making this inevitable discovery argument that you say you made?
Well, we had all the information we had obtained up until this search, which was the one-way cash ticket, nervousness in response to questioning from the agents, untruthful answers, first claiming there's no money, he's not carrying money, there's nothing in the bag of personal items, now there's $50,000 in the bag, and that the fact that the bag was locked, and Mr. Fallon said he did not have a key. Based upon that, that led to the detention of the bag, and back in the office, there was
a reasonable suspicion.
Right.
Where's your probable cause?
The subsequent dog alert, which was not contingent upon the unlawful search.
Do we know whether the dog would have alerted if the bag had not been opened recently?
Well, we do know that the dog did alert to the bag subsequent to the peak.
We know that, but we don't know whether that was because the bag had been opened previously or not, right?
I can't think of any reason why an agent opening a bag, looking and seeing its money and closing it would cause an alteration in what the dog would alert to.
Well, you know, the officers surely knew from drug sniff history that dogs always alert to narcotics when they sniff large amounts of cash. And in a case such as this, where officers know there's a large amount of cash and call in the drug dog, knowing with, you know, pretty much certainty that the dogs will alert to the residue on the cash, regardless of whether drugs are present, can we really say that a positive dog alert supports probable cause for a search warrant? In other words, if dogs always alert to narcotics on cash where no narcotics are found, can such an alert really establish probable cause for the issuance of a search warrant?
It certainly can, and it happens all. And there are many cases from this court, particularly United States versus $30,670, where the court found that the dogs don't alert to actual drugs on the money, but the odor of drugs on the money, and that odor joins the money when it's in.
Were the issues that Judge Ripple and Judge Rovner raised argued in the district court? Is there any evidence in the record on either of these questions?
We never really got to the dog sniff question. It was
why would you not get to it? I mean, in many of these cases, I've seen evidence from dog handlers discussing when dogs alert and when they don't. If you think about the drug on money issue, what the risk of false positives is, there's actually published literature on the risk of false positives. Why was it not put in the record here?
Well, the motion to suppress, the issue raised, as I said before, were two, the encounter on the train and the length of time to get the dog there. Those were the issues that were raised. Those were the issues that evidence was presented on. At the motion to suppress, we did put the dog handler on as a witness, and he basically testified that what he did and that his dog alerted to the bag. But we did not get into any evidence of the substance or the validity.
You're saying the United States never puts in any evidence that doesn't respond to evidence put in by the other side?
Well, in the context of this motion to suppress, it didn't really have any, it wasn't material.
Are you claiming you were unfairly surprised by the district court relying on the opening of the bag by the officer?
Yes. Yes, we were. We conducted this as a civil case. We conducted civil discovery. Our answers to interrogatories. One was not answered because Mr. Fallon's attorney said he was withdrawing his claim and would not participate in answering the interrogatories. Mr. Morocco answered the interrogatories and did not make any claim that there was an unlawful search of the bag. The motion to suppress itself did not argue that there was an unlawful search and that the evidence should be suppressed on that basis.
Assuming that we don't agree with you on that issue, why should we assume that an officer who illegally opened the bag is also going to be an officer who makes sure that dog sniff occurs rapidly afterwards?
In this particular case, it did occur rapidly
well,
afterwards.
After you opened the bag, but would it have occurred rapidly after rapidly if he had not opened the bag and seen the money?
Well, it would have, and in this officer's case, there are other published cases, United States versus Goodwin, for one, where that's what happened. This is what these officers do at the train when
this guy was either thick or arrogant, one or the other. I mean, opening that bank. Now, in either case, whether he was thick or he was arrogant, why should we assume that unless he figured out after opening the bag and seeing the stuff that he better cover his tracks fast, that he really was going to call for the dog?
Well, it was his partner who was actually calling for the dog at the time this was going on. The officer...
Does the record pin down that point of timing?
The district court found that the dog had already been called prior to searching the bag. And that was in the district court's initial ruling on the motion to suppress.
So the district court found that the request for a dog preceded the opening of the bag?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm skimming into my rebuttal time unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kuhn. Mr. Comey.
Good morning on this most historic occasion where our country is going to change directions. And this is my 33rd.
There is no occasion for political speeches in this court.
I'm not making a political speech. I'm just saying...
Please proceed to the argument of this case.
33 years at the bar of this court.
Please proceed to the argument of this case.
This case is the finest example of why the Founding Fathers envisioned the Fourth Amendment. Can you imagine taking the stagecoach between Virginia and Philadelphia and having people pulled off the stagecoach to be inspected? I mean, the envisionment and the promise of the Fourth Amendment was that people wouldn't be hassled in interstate travel, that people would not be subject to searches by officers without probable cause. Clearly, in this case, the district court correctly found that the officer used a knife to enter into somebody's private luggage. And if I remember the jurisprudence of this court, a briefcase is an extension of the pocket. It's like a lady's purse. It's a personal...
Mr. Comey, we're not worried about the illegality of what the officer did. I don't think there's any disagreement. The question is, would the material have been discovered anyway in legal fashion, whether or not the officer had, in fact, committed that illegal act? And what's your position on that?
Judge, my position is that this man was seized off the train, and that had not that seizure taken place, this would not have been discovered in the first instance. Secondly, the open fields doctrine was the fountainhead of inevitable discovery, and the idea was is that you would find the body eventually in the field anyhow, and if the illegal conduct of the police had not taken place, you would have found the body laying in the field of the product of the murder. And that was the fountainhead of the inevitable discovery doctrine, that somehow government would discover the deceased out in the field and would be able to pursue the case anyhow because the body wasn't tainted by the illegal confession.
Well, that was the watershed case, but there's a lot of water under the bridge since then, too. So let's,
sort of like the Mississippi.
Under our jurisprudence, look, the district court said she had the dog had already been called for. The dog was coming. The dog was going to be there. The dog alerted. So the dog was going to find this guy, whether or not that officer opened the bag. That's what you're confronted with. What's your answer?
There are two premises there. One, the dog always finds whenever you have currency, and I direct you to United States versus $506,000, where the great Judge Bauer recites how Janet Reno's purse was submitted to a dog sniff in front of the American Bar Association, hardly a drug dealing crowd. And at that occasion, the dog alerted positively for Miss Reno's purse.
Yes, we're well aware that dogs have errors. We also know from the published literature that the error rate is fairly low, 1 or 2%. I wish you'd address Judge Ripple's question.
My view is it would not be inevitably discovered because it's also possible that when that suitcase was popped open, the hands of the police officer that went into the suitcase contaminated the currency. It's also possible that in the office of the DEA there, where many seizures have taken place, when they opened the suitcase, the currency came in contact with the air in the room where the...
Was this line of argument raised in the district court?
No, because the government didn't bring it to the attention of the district judge.
Well, when we asked the government that question, they said the reason it wasn't raised is because neither Fallon nor Morocco argued in the district court that opening the suitcase was a problem. Is that understanding correct or incorrect?
I believe my memory of the record was is that when I was in the district court on their behalf, we were arguing that the opening of the suitcase was improper. And we now have
a conflict between you. You say the issue was raised, and Mr. Kuhn, who says the issue was not raised. Now, where can we go in the record to see where you raised it?
Report of proceedings obviously resolves all ties. The transcript would resolve all ties with respect to that point. But I remember putting on a hearing where we contested every aspect of this stop in front of the district judge, with the exception that we didn't do the Dalbert dog portion of the case because we never got there. The motion to suppress was granted, and so we didn't go into the next phase of the case with respect to that. And the government, in answer to Judge Rovner's question, waited 80 days. We just sat and waited. I mean, we were wondering, okay, where's the money? Are they going to give the money back to us? Are we going to get a check from the United States Marshal? What's going to happen? And then when the clients became impatient that nothing had happened after the suppression is when I filed the motion for return of property, basically styling it after a rule of criminal procedure 41E, because the detention of the property at that point, I believe, was continuing to be illegal.
Help me out on the dog sniffing the money a little more, if you would, sir. The dog alerts not to the money, but to the if there's a taint of drugs on the money. Is that correct?
Yes. If you look at 506,000 U.S. versus 506, Judge Bauer's case, it appears that the currency is contaminated on the rollers in the banks, so that in the currency in wide circulation in the United States, because some people use cocaine and then handle the money, when that money circulates back through the Federal Reserve System, those rollers then reestablish that on all the bills.
Are you aware of any cases where the simple opening of the briefcase would allow residue to escape and be in the air or on the bag or whatever that might alert a dog falsely?
Well, the problem is we haven't litigated those because the jurisprudence of this court is just starting to move in the direction where we're starting to think in terms of Dalbert hearings. National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers published an article about the dog sniff in its journal, The Champion, and That article is available to you, and I can cite it as additional authority and have it filed if you wish.
The Champion is not exactly scholarly literature. And I referred to the fact that there are scholarly studies subject to peer review published in scientific journals on the rate of false positives of drugs, of dogs alerting to simple currency. And the rate is very low. Now, I assume that that if there are contrary studies, they would certainly be open to us in this case. Do you know of any published scientific studies on the error rate of alerting simply to currency when there's no other relation to drugs?
The direct answer to your question is no, sir, because I didn't prepare for this line of questioning in the opening in the argument here, because I hadn't anticipated you would ask that. I thought we were arguing the question of the opening of the case with the knife, and I was looking at it more of a factual driven by what the record that I had below. I apologize if I didn't look that up before I came here.
Can I take you into a little different area? If Fallon had not missed a train, then the length of his detention, which was 30 to 60 minutes, would likely not have been unreasonable, you know, if he hadn't been made to miss a train. And because it probably would not have been unreasonable, the dog would have inevitably alerted to narcotics and provided probable cause for a search. Since Mr. Morocco had no interest in Fallon's timely travel plans, why was the detention and dog sniff unreasonable as to him?
Well, let's take the law clerk I send to this building with the trial files coming over to this building, and I send them to be in any judge's courtroom down below. And in my briefcase are my work product. In my briefcase are my thoughts about the trial, my attorney-client correspondence. And some government agent can detain the law clerk and search the briefcase without probable cause. I mean, you know, it's unreasonable to be searching people's briefcase without probable cause. And so the key question, I think, the cornerstone question here is probable cause. And if we look at Judge Posner's decision in the United States.
Do you have any response to the Supreme Court's holding in United States against Painter that searching a briefcase in the possession of A in quest of documents that will be used against B does not allow suppression at the behest of B? That's the holding of Painter.
I understand that is the law of the land. I respect the decision of the Supreme Court. However, in this particular...
We're going to follow the Supreme Court.
Sure.
So my question is, do you have a response to any way to distinguish your situation from Painter?
My response is that the lawful possessor, the claimant Fallon, was aggrieved by an unlawful search and seizure. He had possession. As the possessor, he had the lawful right to assert his privacy interests in the briefcase right on the spot, let alone the fact that the district judge found he didn't consent.
Just contradicting the holding of Painter.
Well,
the Supreme Court said that a briefcase could be taken, actually by stealth, from A and searched, and it was then fine to use the evidence against B. Couldn't use it against A, the person from whom the briefcase was taken, but could use it against B. And this was so even though the maneuver was deliberate. That's why I asked whether you have a way to reconcile your position with Painter, and contradicting it is not a way of reconciling.
Government never brought that to the attention of the district judge. Government never suggested that to the district judge. You know, at the time when, if there had been a mistake made here, the record could have been corrected by the district judge, the government didn't bring that to the judge's attention. And so now you have a problem of waiver by the government of that particular approach. I mean, there would have been an opportunity to be heard, an argument, and a decision made by a district judge on that point.
Painter is cited in the government's brief.
We never argued that. We never argued that orally to the judge in the courtroom. We never had that discussion. It might have been tucked into the brief, but it was not discussed.
Mr. Colby, the government said it was surprised. Unfair. And that's why it didn't raise as specifically as it did this inevitable discovery possibility. What's your answer?
answer is that that is an incorrect view of the record for this reason. My colleague is mistaken in that a motion to suppress had to be filed. It had to be docketed by the clerk. The court had to schedule it on the court's calendar. So there was more than ample time. This is not a situation
it
like a traffic court.
That you never argued to the district court, as I understand, counsel, that you never that you wanted the material suppressed because the agent illegally opened the bag.
That was the whole purpose of the motion to suppress, that there was no probable cause. It has to be probable cause to seize the person and the bag.
This now suggests that we're in some uncertainty. The question Judge Ripple asked, the question I asked earlier, the question both of us asked Mr. Kuhn, is whether there was an argument in the district court that opening the bag before the dog arrived was the source of the problem. A simple argument that there was no probable cause doesn't raise a claim that opening the bag at the time to see the cash and then the dog comes is the source of the problem. Now, maybe we're just going to have to read the whole transcript of the hearing. But was this issue raised in a concrete way in the district court?
My best memory was I filed a motion to suppress challenging probable cause. Contained therein would be the requirement of probable cause for both the detention of the bag, since the defendant in this case, the defendant Rez, is the object of the litigation, and secondly, the requirement of probable cause as to the question of the detention of Fallon at the time. So I believe it was raised by the mere filing of the motion with the suggestion that there was an illegal search and seizure. May I proceed now?
Mm-hmm.
If we look to Goodwin, which seems to be the latest pronouncement in these cases, the government, the purpose of this appeal is to spread the Goodwin jurisprudence into this case. And if we look at Goodwin, there are very distinguishing reasons why it shouldn't be accepted here as the fountainhead of the resolution of this case. In Goodwin, the person picked up a ticket within 1 hour of the departure of the train. There was more than 72 hours involving Mr. Fallon in this particular case. Secondly, in Goodwin, there was consent to search. That's a huge distinguishing characteristic between Goodwin and this case.
In other words, what you're saying is that Fallon had come running to the train 2 minutes prior to the train departing. It would turn this into more of a Goodwin situation where a claimant has contributed to the hardship that was brought about by missing the train.
Right.
That's
if we use the Judge Posner calculus as to the weighing, the timing of the purchase.
It really doesn't matter who writes the opinion of the court.
Okay, if we use Goodwin calculus, the Goodwin calculus is basically that the ticket purchase occurring 1 hour before the train departure forces the law enforcement agency not to plan. In this particular circumstance, 72 hours was the district judge's finding. That 72 hours in advance, there was a knowledge of him in the Amtrak ticket system, and that he appeared at the station and aborted the train. There was apparently a period of time before the train was to depart. The decision in Goodwin says is that you have to deal with the question of yanking somebody off a train. Now, if you get an opportunity to listen to the oral argument that occurred and the questions asked by Judge Posner, he was very, very concerned about yanking people off of trains.
And thank you very much, counsel. Judge Rogner, is...
I'm done.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Further, Mr. Kuhn?
Yes.
Mr. Kuhn, the judge makes a finding you waive something. What do you got to show me she clearly erred? I mean, that case comes down to that. I mean, did she clearly err in saying you waived it? What evidence did she ignore?
If you're speaking in terms of whether or not we raise an inevitable discovery,
yeah.
I think the substance of our response to the motion raises the inevitable discovery doctrine, even though we did not use those exact words. That was in substance what we raised. Even if it's properly found to have been forfeited down below, this court can still consider it in the interest of justice.
Got your point. I don't mean to take all your time up. Go ahead.
Okay. In the interest of justice, in a light of the confusion and this, in the surprise, the pretrial surprise, and everything down there, we would ask this court, even if it finds that argument was forfeited, to still consider it. Counsel mentioned United States versus $506,231. That case is, at least for what he cites for, has effectively practically been overruled by the later case of United States versus $30,670, where this court invited the parties to use off the record, outside the record, and publicly empirical data to, so the court to determine whether or not these drug dogs alert to innocent contamination of money or not. And this court specifically ruled that that's not the case, that the drug dogs don't alert to innocent contamination. But in
how accurate dogs are is not a question of law determined by judges. It's a question of fact determined by the world. Now, what do we know in this record about error rates? I don't think there's anything in the record about them. Have the parties referred to the empirical literature one way or the other? I didn't see it in the briefs. Is there some other place?
Not in this particular case, Judge, no.
But one of the officers in this case testified that the dog always alerts to currency.
I don't
trial recall. At 136.25 to 137.1.
Well, I think what he was saying is when the dog does alert, he finds currency or drugs. If the dog doesn't alert to currency, we really have no way of knowing that.
If the dog doesn't alert, the officer doesn't know what the dog didn't alert to.
Yes, that's my point. Thank you. If there are no other questions.
That's why we need to go to the empirical literature where these things are tested, where dogs are presented with samples of things where people actually know what's in all the packages.
Right.
Well, let me just say this. The issue of money contamination, it seems to me, was largely glossed over in the case. But my curiosity was piqued by the comment by the officer that the dog in question always alerts to narcotics on large quantities of money.
Well, only on what he finds.
Well,
as Judge Eastwood pointed out, if he doesn't alert, we don't know what's there. But when he does alert, they find money, and that's what these dogs are trying to do, find drugs and drug-tainted currency.
Or drugs.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.